Testing mic one. Testing mic one. Testing mic two. Testing mic two.
Well, let me ask. Throw out another thing that, as Bill knows, the Institute has a grant from Ford Foundation with the state energy policy, and so far we haven't implemented it. And the other thing is that there is some money in the Institute to take on some other problems that are associated with this but aren't directly within the terms of the contract with the state, with the legislative affairs. And you might think about problems that are not encompassed here. For instance, where if the gas line isn't built, what are the alternatives to the state? Or how does the state cope in a planning and financial sense with a worst case scenario from the state's point of view, that is a real erosion of energy markets worldwide? I don't want to answer that necessarily now.
Kind of on Fred's question, it seems to me what is more happens before the question of getting the pipeline done and then something happening to your markets. It's the more likely thing is that we get in a position in the next 12 months that it's obvious that nobody is going to sign any long-term contracts, and that the project doesn't go ahead because at that point because nobody is going to finance it. And so that would seem to me that that's a more pertinent question to us right now, is that if that were to happen, is there anything we can do about it, or what can be done? It's been made clear to us, I think, that nobody is going to be interested in financing until those contracts are sitting on the table. And what if, it seemed possible to me, if the market is kind of in flux, that people might be willing to sign short-term contracts, but not long-term. And so, do we have any alternatives at that point? Is there anything we can do to get the thing moving? And I imagine Northwest is going to be in the same situation, looking at those alternatives, but they're obviously going to be looking at what they can do, and maybe we ought to be looking at if there's anything we can do to keep the project going ahead.
Well, I've always interpreted that as really as the bottom line, as to what we're finally to come up with an assessment. Is this thing going to go without state intervention? What are the alternatives for state intervention? What are their costs and risks? And then it's got to be up to you people, to the legislature collectively, the state administration, the people, to decide whether the benefits from having the pipeline are worth these costs and risks.
But we've been talking about it in terms of us taking a financial role, will help on the financing, but we haven't necessarily been taking a look at the specific problem that there's so what if we took a role in financing that it wasn't making any difference because the real problem was there was no long-term sales contract? Could we do something about that problem specifically, not just make this decision it'll help out if we're in there, but that there is a specific problem, not this general attitude.
Well, coming up with a long-term sales whether people are willing to sign long-term sales contracts depends on their perception of what the cost of the gas is going to be, what the time profile of that tariff is going to be. And so there may be some way that you're talking about ways that the state could underwrite those risks to the potential purchasers.
Well, I don't know what alternative to talk about, but what you're projecting is saying it's going to be a buyer's market. It's a buyer's market. Well, why the hell should any of the buyers want to make long-term commitments? It's not to their advantage. And, so what do we do about that?
Any other comments or questions?
Yes, the other thing, massage again, the impact that the front-end loading on the tariff might have to shortening up the period of time they might have signed contracts.
We'll take a break for lunch. On the agenda, we'll move up Birch Horton status report till immediately after lunch. Be back at 1:30 if you could.
Yeah. What? We had a great meal Saturday night.
Having in Washington and then return to the regular schedule. So, Ron?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Under the contract which we have with this committee, we've begun identifying the federal officials for the survey of current perceptions of state responsibilities with respect to financing and have held preliminary meetings with FERC and John Ager of AGPO. We're also researching the state impact effects on National Gas Policy Act and possible leverage against the state that the federal government might utilize if the state determines not to participate in the Northwest Project. Additionally, we've talked with Attorney General Gross about the suit which has been brought by Texas, Louisiana, and Oklahoma against the federal government regarding, in quote, states' rights issues affected by the Natural Gas Act, which was just passed.
Is that Shell versus FERC, or is that?
Different case. I believe Randall has a report on Shell versus FERC. The status of the incentive rate of return situation. We have forwarded up the filings filed by Northwest. I don't know if Mr. Backman has also provided the committee with the most recent filings that you've had with the current projection that my office in D.C. has is that FERC will reach a final decision within the next 60 to 75 days. I don't know if that...
On what?
On the incentive rate of return.
Say they're supposed to, it's on the docket for Wednesday.
But that's not going to be a final decision.
Well, it won't be final.
We disagree on Section 103. We feel that without the full support of both Alaskan senators, Section 103 amendment is not going to happen. I wasn't privy to the San Francisco meeting. It's my understanding that Senator Gravel said it was dead, but not that he would act in opposition to it.
That's right.
So if there's a way of breathing life into it, that'll have to be done with Ms. McMillan in Washington.
Sam?
Maybe you'd like to expand on that a little bit more. I mean, aside from the possibility that both senators would support it, apparently Treasury's dead set against it, as well as you know, the administration. And this note that Jerry provided for us that shows that there won't be any federal subsidy, at least this was in the conference report. And I suppose some people view that 103 exemption as a subsidy and some don't. Maybe you'd like to expand on that a little bit.
Well, you know, you've said it all, really, sir. Without Gravel and Stevens actively pushing it as a priority matter.
Well, what if they were?
I think then it might happen as a tack on to some other bill. I don't know what McMillan has in mind in terms of saying it's now alive again, but we don't have that reading.
All he's saying, really, and not to interrupt, but is it properly packaged, it could go. And he's, when he's saying properly packaged, he's referring to the exemption that would specifically benefit this project. Not
and no
the,
other big energy project.
No, nothing else tacked onto it.
Well, I don't think Senator Gravel was expressing his own non-support. I just think that my impression was that he was just saying, well, it's dead because we couldn't get the support for it, mm-hmm. regardless of whether he was for it.
Well, one of the reasons that couldn't get the support for it, obviously related to the D2 BAP, you know, chits were being cashed left and right, and there was no room left for chits on 103. And I don't see that battle abating over the next 6 or 7 months, the D2 BAP. And we're intimately involved in that. I don't think 103 is going to happen. But we'll file a full report on that at Christmas time.
Will that include other people in Congress's opinion about the thing?
Yes. Okay. One of the things you have is virtually a whole new Senate Energy Committee. You have 5 or 6 new faces on the Senate Energy Committee. It's a tough game to predict in the Senate. But I just don't see a wellhead of enthusiasm behind the 103 exemption.
A wellhead?
Really. I'll have to read Arlen's report to make sure my terminology is correct. Other than that, we're working on providing the preliminary reports as requested by the committee. The first drafts are due January 15th. And we've been responsive to various committee inquiries from Senator Coletta, Senator Sumner, and Representatives Miles and Chatterton. One of the matters we worked on, Senator Coletta may wish to address himself to, relating to the royalty gas, which thanks to Senator Coletta, we were successful on in a very short period of time. Mike, maybe you'd like to speak to that?
Well, I believe all the members are familiar with that. But, you know, the energy bill gives President Austin powers, and we want to know if those things extended to Alaska's royalty share of gas. We're able to get what they call a colloquy that has this full effective law as amended into the passage of that bill and part of it that excludes Alaska. So, you know, it just strengthens, and it does not in any way the energy bill, even under his emergency powers, negate 13B that we fought so hard to get a couple years ago. So that was an expenditure well worth the time and effort that was spent, and we were successful with it. It leads me to believe, guys, that sometimes the best way to get something is not with a whole bunch of planning, but to just go and you catch them in a day or two. And and those colloquies are something we should keep in mind. What a tool that is. You don't ask anybody. You just get the prime sponsor of the measure to sign off, and they present it to secretary, and he doesn't even read it. Just become part of the bill. Neat maneuver.
Are you proposing we institute that?
I don't know, but you know, it's a time and a place.
But,
it's not like a letter of intent.
In very brief summation, the next 6 to 9 months is going to be critical, in our opinion, in terms of whether this project is go or no go. I question whether or not a report to the legislature on January 15th with a final report on March 15th is going to really meet the legislature's needs in terms of decision making. There's nothing less enchanting than filing reports that are outdated, you know, 3 months later, when the legislature has to address itself to the issue being discussed. We're on track, and you know, we'll be able to file by January 15th and March 15th, but the committee may want to consider extending our final report deadline to April or May 15th, so that would be consistent with the committee's work. Otherwise, the committee is going to be sitting with a March 15th report come May 15th. That'll be rather meaningless.
The committee has to consider extending itself to.
Yeah. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have. It's
Ron, maybe Jack can answer this. The plan is for when Senator Gregory returns, preferred to meet Wednesday. You suggested that 60 to 75 days, they may come down with their ruling. Is that a final ruling? Or what I understood that Jack to say was that they may shortly thereafter come down with a range.
We're consistent with each other. What Jack is saying is that on Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday, he's hopeful that that FERC will be giving the parameters of where their decision is going to be heading. And the best information we have is that within about 2 months after the Wednesday hearing, FERC will be coming down with its final decision.
With its final definitive decision.
That's their present program. It could slip as much as 2 years, as you know. But, you know, that's what they're saying now.
Jack, is that just...
That's consistent. I rather expect it to slip further than the 60 to 70 days, actually. Okay.
But is that range, if they do come down shortly with the range, is that adequate to go to the financiers with?
Depends on how hard it is. I think it very well might be.
Uh-huh. but you're not expecting it to be real hard.
Well, I think the parameters are going to be well set. They've had lots of hearings and lots of information.
Yeah, but a 14% to 15% range is a lot harder than a 12% to 20% range.
Right. Let's wait till Thursday to decide what they say.
Okay. Grant?
Chair, I just ask a question of both Jack and Ron in terms of whether we're talking about just phase one of the incentive rate of return or phase two, and if what their views are on how phase two is going to be addressed. And also maybe the significance of phase two. My impression is phase two is as significant, if not more significant, than phase one. Maybe Jack would disagree with that, I don't know.
No, I really don't have any opinion, personal opinions, Fred. I can't even discuss with you.
But is your final decision in 60 to 75 days?
I think to both phases.
Both phases?
That's our understanding.
Can I ask a clarifying question? Can you explain phase one, phase two to the committee?
Yeah, phase one is they now have the structure, which has about five or six key elements called the center point and the marginal rate and all that sort of thing. And the idea now in phase one is to assign some numbers to those different elements. Phase two addresses the concept of what costs are going to be included and what costs are going to be excluded for purposes of deciding whether they're meeting their defined costs or not. For the example that has been discussed sometimes in the past has been a dock strike on the West Coast, which prevents construction materials from getting to Alaska. Is Northwest responsible for that if that results in a six-month delay, a dock strike, something like that results in a six-month delay, and does the cost incurred as a result of that delay result in them receiving a lower rate of return? There are a whole host of questions like that. What kind of inflation factor is going to be used, which are to be addressed in phase two, and which I would have thought have to be really pretty firmly answered before anybody understands the full impact of that rule.
That was addressed to FERC in written form, to which they've not replied. Again, I'm anxious to hear what they come down with or what comes out of their pontifications this week.
You think they will be proposing a preliminary phase two rule?
I think they will. Or at least they'll declare a policy.
And that Jack, again, that's enough to go to the bank with?
If they set the outside parameters far enough apart and well enough established, I think it is.
They have not, Mr. Chairman, they have not given an indication in the past that they view the time compression that's attendant to this project as strictly as this committee views it, and certainly as Northwest seems to view it. FERC doesn't seem to have the same sense of urgency that everybody else, from Cussing to Backman to Birch to Miles, to his table, seem to have on it. I think Arlen touched on something previously, and that is, had the rulemaking process been carried on within the parameters of what we knew would be a natural gas bill someday, we'd be about a year ahead of ourselves now, but it wasn't. It wasn't being treated as a brand new baby.
Questions from Mr. Birch? Anything else, Ron?
I have nothing further.
Thank you very much. Next item on the agenda is Senator Coletta.
The committee as a whole did go to San Francisco, including the ex officio members. There isn't a great deal that I can tell you regarding that visit.
Except that the mayor of San Francisco has been shot right after you left. What is that doing?
Some people just weren't listening. But nonetheless, Jack, I don't know how you viewed it. I'd be curious in your opinions either now or later, but I viewed what we undertook in San Francisco as another gesture, at least on this committee's part, to explore every possible way to create an entity to export the state's gas from Prudhoe Bay. And that's where we're at. If one alternative, it'd be well to just have these other alternatives, since time seems to be of importance to the state's best interest. That was the reason for the trip, and we're all aware of what transpired there. The only issue that we have not addressed that we have to now is that you all know that Kelso is undertaking a conceptual design for the state of Alaska through budget and audit. And rather than enter into a new contract with him for a specific negotiated an add-on to what he's currently doing that would affect pipelines, and for that would necessitate an expenditure of $25,000 from this committee. The administration will come with from $10,000 to $15,000 additional dollars for counter-financial evaluation of what Kelso prepares. Budget model, of course, is picking up the $180,000. That's where we are on that trip. To me, it may turn out to be a more volatile proposal than 103 has to offer the state or the pipeline. Then my report.
Okay. No comment. I was just going to make a motion.
Yeah, we should be mad.
What? Can we go ahead and make the motion if you want to have...
Why don't you go ahead and make the motion?
Okay. I'd move that the committee approve spending $25,000 to add to the contract with Lewis Kelso to specifically design a financing mechanism for pipelines.
Okay. I think it's heard the motion. Any comments or questions on that? All of us in favor?
Aye.
Raise your right hand. Well,
that's your
mind. Okay, that's unanimous, assuming Senator Ferguson will go along with that. I'll take the first responsibility to contact one of those members to see if anything goes. Anything else on that subject? Washington, or Canada, just recently, for those who aren't aware, several members of the committee and staff made a 9-day swing through Canada, stopping in 5 cities, talking with various government and private officials, private enterprise officials. For me, personally, as one of the members who went along, it was undoubtedly the most educational trip that I've ever been on, government service. Very briefly, Larry Effenbach, who essentially set the trip up, will give a report on who we talked to, and then I'll talk about some of the conclusions that seem to be unanimous. And please bear in mind that a full report is coming, will be made available to the committee. You've been given a preliminary report in 2 phases, but the full report in much more detail will be coming 4 o'clock tonight, Larry?
Yeah, 4:30.
Okay. Larry, you're out.
Okay. I'll give everybody a minute. Sorry I didn't bring more copies of this. Probably there'll be only 3 or 4 available for the audience. Can I ask some of you to share in the audience who would like
here.
To look at this?
Here's another one. No, I'll just look at the same.
I remember what I did.
Let me hear you recite every place.
Well, very briefly, as Co-Chairman Miles suggested, there was a trip to Canada. And in summary, I should say that we visited Alberta oil and gas producers in Alberta, the center of commercial activity in Alberta being Calgary, Alberta regulators in the center of government of Alberta province, Edmonton. We visited with the financial community and with TransCanada Pipeline in Toronto. And then in Ottawa, we visited with some of the federal regulatory people. And this little summary, meeting itinerary, comments, and preliminary findings, very briefly covers those meetings. Names who we've met with, when, where, and adds a sentence or two about the gist of the findings. It's not meant to be a summary statement or even include all the vital information, but simply give you a feel for some of the information that the committee learned while talking to these individuals. And I might go through some of that very, very briefly for the benefit of those who don't have a copy of this report. As suggested by Arlen Twissing earlier, we did in fact talk to Canadian Hunter, John Masters, and he was suggesting that there may be as much as 440 TCF of gas available in the Deep Basin area of Alberta. He suggested that about 50 TCF of that could be recoverable for a recovery cost of about a dollar an MCF, and a total of 150 recoverable for an average recovery cost of $2 per MCF. He further suggested that that similar attractive deep gas deposits may be available north of the Brooks Range. He was a geologist. Geologists are naturally optimistic, and it might be interesting to point out here that the vice chairman of the NEB, which is equivalent to our Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, suggested that they weren't going to place a very great value on these speculative reserve forecasts. Later that morning, we met with the representatives from Panarctic, in fact, the comptroller. Panarctic is a consortium of about 30 companies interested in developing the Arctic Island area of gas deposits in the very northern area of Canada. And they're proposing that there be a pipeline down the west coast of Hudson Bay, a very long, expensive, and high-pressure pipeline to transport that gas to Ontario province. Unfortunately, they've only now proven up about 13 TCF of gas. The project needs considerably more gas to be economic, and so they're kind of in a hold mode. And in fact, Petro-Canada, the Crown Corporation developing oil and gas reserves in Canada, owns already 45%, and I don't want to speculate, but it seemed to me, as one observer, that if anything, that percentage of government ownership may increase in the Pan-Arctic Consortium. We next met with Bill Hopper, president of Petro-Canada, and later with some of his staff that were proposing an LNG pilot project. Bill Hopper is probably the best representative of the aggressive, talented, well-trained, large corporation executive. And it was interesting to find that this corporation is entirely owned by the federal government of Canada. It's a Crown corporation, and yet it has moved as aggressively as any in the area of oil and gas development. Perhaps some other members of the committee would like to comment on
point. The main thing we heard from them was on the LNG. Are you going to talk about
that? I'm going to get to that on page two. They're proposing a method of removing gas from the Arctic Islands to the east coast of the U.S. or Canada by the use of two large, heavily clad, very heavily powered LNG ice-breaking tankers. They're proposing that the project transport 250 MCF a day of gas, and that the whole thing cost about $1.75 billion, or $1.67 billion, dollars. Now, their costs of transportation under this scenario works out to about $4 per MCF.
Go ahead.
Pause. Excuse me. I'm reading off this.
Oh,
150 megawatts, which is over 150,000 horsepower.
Oh, okay.
Did I say 150,000 megawatts?
No, you said 150.
Yeah. For those of you who don't understand, there's a relationship between megawatts and horsepower, and 150 megawatts is somewhat more than 150,000 horsepower. It's on the average of, say, five times more powerful than the Manhattan tanker, and hence perhaps very efficient to run in ice and not so efficient economically to run in clear water.
Figures.
Okay. Later that day, we met with Dome Petroleum, which is a highly integrated oil company, and they came up with a suggestion we hadn't heard before and before since, and that is that of the several proposals in Canada to export gas, they being a pro-gas proposal to move gas east and south through the Trans-Canada pipeline, the Pan-Alberta project, a proposal that we've already heard to transport 1 billion MCF of gas a day through the pre-building the southern portion of the Alaska Highway Pipeline line, and two other proposals. Of those four, there may be some movement here to integrate them, and that the NEB may have the opportunity of reshaping those proposals and come up with just one decision next July. No one else mentioned that, and that may or may not happen. The following day, we met with Alberta Gas Trunkline. It's one of the two big partners in the Foothills project, the Canadian half of this Alaska Highway Pipeline project. We met with Bob Pierce, who's the executive vice president, and a great number of his staff. The major conclusion there was that Alberta Gas Trunkline appeared ready to go ahead with their portion of the line. They evidenced a great interest in pursuing it, in having built similar pipelines. They displayed a confidence that they could go ahead and bring this pipeline in at the cost estimate or below. And he further added that the key now is to look to sales contracts to support financing of the entire pipeline. Later that morning, we talked to Harold Milliken of the Northern Pipeline Agency, and that was also brought up by either Harold or someone else as the one-window pipeline agency in Canada just recently started, in fact, in 1978, I believe, in the spring of 78, this was put together, and already it is being staffed and brought up to speed and has moved aggressively in the area of trying to find settlements for the native claims issue in Yukon Territory, Northwest, and BC. And I should add here that I think a critical difference between Canada and the U.S. is the fact that in Canada, or I should say between Canada and Alaska, is that in Canada, a legal preference in law can be and has been granted to Native Northerners who have lived there prior to April 1, 1977. So they have simply eliminated their local hire question by putting it into law. We could not do that. They've also planned to address that question by requiring that all outside construction workers go first to Calgary or Edmonton to be hired, and they simply will refuse to hire them through Whitehorse. And that double-barreled approach, I think, will go a long way to solving that problem. Well, skipping down a little bit, am I going too fast, or is this just about the right kind of summary? Okay. I'm trying to pick up some of the interesting aspects of it. We see a last meeting in Calgary, maybe of interest. We met with the senior vice president of Alberta Energy Company, and that's an interesting small company. It's 50% owned by small shareholders and 50% owned directly by the Alberta government. And it's got 200 employees. They're in a diverse series of activities, synthetic crude pipeline ownership, coal mine, a third of an ethylene gathering system, and has some exploratory drilling rights. But I think most important was the fact that they had a management philosophy that seemed very successful for a small quasi-government-owned corporation. They were willing to take a minority interest in any project until they personally had acquired the management expertise to then assume control. And so we, and I don't want to speak for everyone, but I should say I judge that they were not likely to make the mistakes of other corporations getting in too quickly without having built up internal expertise. And this government corporation, like so many others, seemed to have talented people working for them, offering high salaries and aggressive opportunities to people working there. Well, we moved from Calgary very quickly to Edmonton for a day. And I think a significant meeting was the meeting with the Alberta Provincial Treasury. The bottom line of that meeting was the fact that they haven't even been addressed, not even requested to
to invest the Heritage Fund of Alberta Province, which is today probably close to $4 billion, in the Foothills project. When speculatively asked if they would be interested, there was some discussion, and the result was that I think at least a consensus view of their own was that yes, they would be interested in receiving a debt proposal, that is a proposal to buy or to look at buying some of the debt capital, the debt issues that Foothills may offer, but certainly not on the equity side. And that view was supported later on with a discussion by one of the ministers of Alberta, who suggested that the Alberta government, which would eventually have to rule on any such investment of the Heritage Fund, would simply rule out equity investment by Alberta Province in the Foothills project.
Did you ask why is no equity
and debt
purchase with a discount?
Excuse me, Senator, did I ask why no equity, or did you ask a second question?
The explanation as to why they didn't participate in the equity position that would look at
the debt instead. Well, I didn't specifically ask that question, but I sense that their answer was the risk-reward associated with each. They hadn't, to this point, made extensive equity commitments into any project. They were quite conservative and security-oriented into their investments up until this time, and I think it would be breaking new ground philosophically as well as administratively for them to invest in equity. The minister who we talked to, and perhaps the co-chairman would be better able to respond to this myself, I judged was against equity investment on strictly philosophical grounds and echoed the cabinet's view for that reason. They were not about to have Alberta Province involved in this manner in the pipeline.
A lot of people still have the view, or have the view in Canada that the proposed pipeline is merely passing gas through Canada that doesn't belong to them. It's Alaska gas, and now they're just letting us build a pipeline. That sentiment was indicated to us on one occasion, and therefore it's beyond the realm of an equity question.
But, Mr. Chairman, you had indicated, though, that's a philosophy that reigns there apparently in all projects, whether or not it's this one or not. Is that true?
No. Well, yes and no. A conservative philosophy with respect to such direct equity investments by their trust fund, mm-hmm. Yes. But in terms of that province's support of, say, a government-owned oil company directly or even indirectly, then no. I mean, for the trust fund, yes. And there's some contradictions in application of their philosophy to us.
It seems like their interest is in this was not so great because it's something that they didn't have direct control over causing development necessarily in Alberta, whereas the Alberta Energy Development Corporation was going out and causing development in certain areas that might not otherwise happen, which they felt
long-term employment.
Yeah,
right.
Which they said we're getting other benefits.
I don't think they were really expecting an offer or a request from the companies because of the fact that the fund itself, they kind of had guidelines that they had to demand the going interest rate, which was right now close to a percentage point different than the U.S. markets, and so they all along kind of felt like the debt would come out of the U.S. anyway. Right?
That's right.
So they weren't even real expecting to receive a request.
We sort of fooled them in the last few weeks with our interest rate.
They said it's usually between 1.5 and 2 point spread, but now it's down to 0.6 and
closing.
It could be a little closer than that now. So.
Maybe, well, let me get onto that subject because we did go to Toronto after Edmonton and ask those kind of questions to some of the financial advisors there. Before I get into that, I should say first we talked to TransCanada, which is one of the large, in fact, the largest gas transmission company in North America. It transports gas from Alberta Province in the west eastward to Ontario, Quebec. And if additional proposals are accepted by the NEB eventually to the maritime provinces all the way to the East Coast. They're a major gas transmission company. In a sense, they're a competitor to the northern border or the eastern leg, pre-building portion of the
of this Alaska Highway project, because gas not shipped through the Eastern Lake could presumably be shipped through Canada, through Trans-Canada. And in fact, they had once been a member of the Foothills Consortium, but even though having dropped out, they still evidence support for the entire project. They stay quiet on the subject of their competitive position vis-a-vis the Eastern Lake. So I think it's useful to know that, that even a company like TransCanada, which would on the surface have substantial interest in competing with it, doesn't tend to go around saying, don't build the entire project. When it comes to looking at the entire project, they tend to support it. And similar support came from the financial community, getting back to that question, and asking a lot of probing questions from independent financial advisory firms, from Dominion Securities, which is the advisor to Alberta Gas Trunkline, and there's other firms, Pitfield, First Boston was there, and others we met with, all suggested that the Canadian companies responsible for building the Foothills line shall have no trouble raising the equity they need in Canada. And on the question of raising the debt portion in the U.S., it was, in fact, due to the interest spread available in the past on bonds raised in the United States being about 1% or 1.5% on the average cheaper than Canadian bonds. I asked questions about the long-term impact of having those spreads narrow, and they suggested that even at the present rates, there would continue to be an incentive to raise the debt capital in the United States. And in fact, they saw no other factors, either tax or interest rate increases or anything else, that would change their conclusion that the Canadian portion is quite financeable. The debt portion in the U.S., the Canadian equity portion in Canada. Let me go on to Ottawa, because I think that was the significant inclusion in Toronto being the financing. In Ottawa, we met with a number of people in meetings arranged by the United States Ambassador to Canada, Mr. Tom Enders. And I think one of the most useful meetings was with Mitchell Sharp, the Commissioner of the Northern Pipeline Agency. And he, in fact, was deputy to the Minister of Energy back in 1957 when the Trans-Canada gas pipeline was financed, and has, because of that, a long history of involvement in energy transmission projects. He is the commissioner for the Northern Pipeline Agency, and I think has moved as effectively as anyone could ever ask to have that that agency address the problems in Canada. And the parallel between that agency's efforts in Canada and what's happening in the U.S. is rather startling. And they, because of that, appear to be well in advance of the United States in terms of having the Canadian pipeline ready to go ahead. He being Mitchell Sharp again, has been very active in negotiations with the United States with respect to the Canadian content of the pipeline and lots of other issues, that not all of which are resolved. The ambassador and Mitchell Sharp and others are still negotiating on a number of these key factors. But enough has been resolved to suggest that there's not going to be any stumbling blocks in that area in terms of going ahead and building the pipeline. We talked to the finance ministry to probe the question of whether or not the federal government in Canada would be willing to support the pipeline in any way, speculatively, whatever, and got from Tom Shoyama, who is the deputy minister of finance and one of the senior deputy ministers in Canada. And I might make an aside there. Unlike the U.S. and the Alaska situation, deputy ministers in Ottawa are typically very, very powerful. They have great longevity. They are not subject to the politics of administrations coming in and out, and so develop over the years a great deal of effective authority. And Tom has been there, I think, as long as any deputy minister in Iowa, and speaks with considerable clout for the Ministry of Finance, and reinforced rather directly the opinion that the Canadian administration has no intention of supporting the Foothills portion of the line financially. Perhaps one might speculate that, unlike the U.S., they don't have to. It was clear from our other findings that no one had asked them to, and there was no positive incentive for them to do it. They, as a country, saw benefits in construction and lots of other secondary benefits of having that gas line, but saw only political risks involved in actually coming up with hard financing to support it. And so in light of that, I think one should conclude that there will be no direct financial support for the line out of Ottawa.
One thing that with TransCanada that they brought, that I think Mitchell Sharp brought this up about, that the Canadian government had got involved way back when, in 1956 or whatever the date was, in financing the TransCanada line, but it was only at the point when it became absolutely clear to them that it wouldn't go otherwise, and I mean there was no doubt in anybody's mind, and then what they did instead of just helping finance, they took over control of part of the line, and built, and well, they didn't actually construct, but they were the owner of that portion of the pipeline, and they weren't necessarily involved with the other owners. They just had their portion of the pipeline in the middle there, but they built into the system, and which is what he emphasized, a system for the industry to buy the government back out. So that they, what it was, it became increasing, the tariff would become increasingly expensive for them if they didn't buy them out. So they engineered in a way to get the government back out. But when they went in all the way. You know, they didn't have a management responsibility, but they actually owned the middle of the pipeline.
In a sense, it was a form of government backstopping, but without any of the long-term implications, given the fact that the pipeline was successful and cash flow was generated enough so that the other companies could buy out TransCanada. And today, TransCanada is just like any other public utility. It's a regulated gas pipeline. Some of the people at the Department of Energy, Mines, and Resources. And they took a somewhat different view with respect to the allocation of Canadian supply and demand for gas. As some of you know, the government in Ottawa has supported the movement of Alberta gas eastward. And opposing that have been East Coast refiners, who see an excess of refinery capacity already, and if gas was moved in to displace fuel oil, then even more of their capital-intensive investment in refining would remain unused. And we asked Digby Hunt, who was the assistant deputy minister in the Department of Energy, Mines, and Resources, about all that, and he said that today there's about 600,000 barrels a day capacity of unused oil refining capacity on the east coast of Canada, and that in spite of that, the government's policy is to continue to want to subsidize the movement of gas from the west coast, from the west producing province, Alberta, in Canada, eastward into Ontario and in the future into Quebec. He added in a question and answer period that went into a number of subjects, added that petrochemical investment in Canada and hinted in Alaska and everywhere else was quite a risky adventure. And I'm not going to talk to that in general, but the committee asked a number of questions with respect to the experience of Alberta province and a number of other provinces in petrochemical. I think at that point I'll wind up with the thought that all of this is just meant to bring those members of the committee who weren't there up to first level, I do intend to prepare a more appropriate report that deals with this issue by issue. Any specific questions any of you would like to have addressed in that report, don't hesitate to ask now or then. And with that, I'll go to the finding phase with Coach Chairman.
Okay. Any questions for Larry?
I'd like to urge that maybe we talk to them again by phone or something and see if any data or studies or whatever that led them to the conclusions or in the directions that they took might be available, and if they might in turn share those with us.
In the course of this trip, we collected several box loads of information reports, and we'd be glad to make those available, but I think what you're asking for is a concise summary of those reports.
Something that would offer some direction.
I will go through those when they arrive, looking for that kind of direction.
I think, you know, some of the things we heard them saying, like with the Alberta setting up the Alberta Energy Corporation, is very similar things, philosophical things you hear in Alaska. They said, all the money was going to go to the outsiders, and they wanted something to make sure that people who lived in Alberta were going to get something out of it. It wasn't just going to be owned by a bunch of outsiders and pumped out, and then that was it. It was gone. And so they, when they set this up, they actually had a stock sale, $7.5 million, and the people, the citizens of Alberta, bought the stock when the government set up the company.
They oversubscribed to it.
And it was sold at $10 a share, and it's now worth $16 a share. And then the government owns the other half, but there's something like 50,000 people in Alberta actually bought stock, you know. And, you know, they obviously were willing to invest their money, but their real concern at that time was who was going to own this? You know, were people in Alberta going to, or was it just going to be outsiders? And that, you know, it sounded real familiar hearing those kind of arguments as to why they were doing it.
And presumably a major part of the construction, et cetera, occurred in their own economy by their own people.
Oh, yeah, I think that's their real consideration with the whole pipeline project is more related to that than anything else, too.
Did somebody offer just a, you know, a real quick review of the Heritage Fund?
Quick review is a $4 billion.
The quick review is that June 30th, 1978, the balance was $3.6 billion. It's growing at, rule of thumb, would be close to $1 billion a year. It's invested presently in a number of secure interest-earning investments. And if I recall, the managers the managers did suggest to us that there would be more speculative investments in the sense of socially oriented investments being proposed by the administration in Alberta, but they haven't come yet, and they haven't faced that issue. And so there was nothing there in terms of actions already taken that would help, say, the state of Alaska resolve the investment question with respect to our permanent fund.
They seem to be pretty wide open as far as options, and the government itself made those decisions on where the money would be invested, but they weren't restricted by a legislative mandated investment plan, if you will.
Some of the bucks were set aside for legislative mandates, but the others were made by the Heritage Fund people themselves, the money managers, actually.
They actually had the fund divided up into three chunks, and the first two were real small chunks, though. One of they call it the Capital Projects Division, and these were actually just appropriated funds that, you know, were not investments. They were just appropriated out for various projects, but this was could only amount to less 5% or less of the annual income. So it was a very small portion that could actually go to just outright appropriations, and then I think up to 15%. Is what they called the Canada Investment Division. But I don't think that was too active yet.
They made some loans to someplace in the east, right?
Yeah, but, oh yeah, to the other provinces.
To the other governments.
To the other provinces for kind of economic projects they had. But a lot of their money was actually in things like they bought up
housing mortgages of different housing authorities, you know, similar to, say, like Alaska Housing Finance or something. They were actually buying up mortgages of that and municipal bond issues and things like that. So they, but they, there's still a considerable amount that, that was not invested in Alberta because they, their perspective was that they would superheat the economy and that. But they did really make the point that it's new for them, and they and what we saw today wasn't necessarily what would be there in the next few years, and it might be changing.
They're going slow.
The best part was when we went to the brain cell where they had all the people pushing all the computers and spending all the money.
Yeah. And they had $2 billion left over that they just had.
Oh, surplus. But the Alberta, the Treasury itself had a huge surplus too. What was it? It was in the billions there too, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I might add that unlike the Alaska situation, I was delighted to go in as a Treasury officer because their Treasury in Alberta is very much like our departments of administration, natural resources, commerce, and revenue all in one. The Treasurer of Alberta province has tremendous clout and collects taxes and handles all of the state accounting, the provincial accounting, and all of the cash flow management, all the typical Treasury operations, all of the trust accounting, and it was a delight as an ex-time
getting Eppenbach away from it.
Well, the pattern of the future. And this trading room that was mentioned is really quite impressive, even compared to the trading rooms of Merrill Lynch or, you know, some of the big houses in New York. It was a nice one.
Financial
stuff. Yeah. Mr. Turner, I was just going to make observations about the Alberta Heritage Fund, and I met with their officials just over a year ago. The most striking thing is that unlike the Alaskan situation, the investment decisions are made by orders in council, as they call that, is to say the cabinet of the province makes the decisions. And that, of course, is a remarkable departure from anything that's been contemplated here. The legislature hasn't been inclined to have the governor and his cabinet take care of the investments.
But they're the legislature and the governor.
Governor are fused into
They're one of the same, people.
By design, I
think. Oh, that's the Canadians.
Yeah, you have to be a cabinet member. You have to be elected to a parliament, and then they're plunked out of the parliament, made of ministers.
But also, as Larry intimated before, they have very few political figures sitting in administrative posts. Great vast part of the civil service continues between the ministers. The second point is that the Alberta Heritage Fund openly votes any subsidies that are involved with their investment program. And the one example I recall is that they've committed a great deal of money to bringing down the price of mortgages for middle and lower income groups. And I was shown a bill that shows the rates at which homeowners are charged. And then in great bold-faced type, it says subsidy, which has to be openly voted on the floor of the parliament.
Let's say who voted for it.
Yes, right. How much money is involved, who is getting it, and who wanted to have it. And the simple rationale is that the fund's earnings are not to suffer because of some social aim of the parliament.
Any other questions for Larry? Essentially, there were two things that left out, I think, to all the folks who made the trip. First, with regard to the pipeline itself, that the Canadians are ready to go, and they at least wanted us to take back the feeling. I think that they're waiting on the United States. Their regulatory two main regulatory agencies, the National Energy Board, is currently, while we were there, having supply and demand hearings to determine just exactly what the excess gas may be, and they'll have a report out in February. Northern Pipeline Agency, this is the much heralded one-window approach, is active. Mitchell Sharp is the the commissioner of the agency, and he's a much revered man in Canada, many long years of public service. They have an administrator who we met with, Harold Milliken, and they're very actively in support of seeing that the pipeline goes, that it's made as essentially as easy as possible for Foothills and Alberta Gas Trunk Line. So from that standpoint, from a regulatory standpoint, the Canadians are ready to go and substantially ahead of us. From a financial standpoint, and we talked not only to financial consultants of the Foothills AGTL people, but also of the loyal opposition. And again, got the same response both from the friendly side and the not-so-friendly side, that they're ready to go. They're proposing $1 billion in equity to be raised within Canada, and they indicate that when everything falls in place in the United States, that there shouldn't be any problem. Well, there'll be a problem, but raising $1 billion is a problem anytime, but that they will be able to raise $1 billion in equity and the balance of debt in the United States. So they're ready and willing and able to go when the United States, in essence, gets its act together.
And we labored so long under the apprehension that maybe they wouldn't be ready to go when we got
there. We asked questions like things that came up here in our deliberation. Well, what about land claims? And they seem to feel that land claims aren't going to be a real problem. That the government, by mutual consent, their government, the United States government, said it's going to go, and they'll take the necessary moves to what they call expropriate the land, and it will go. And they're going to be negotiating in good faith all along to try and resolve the land claims problems, but it seems that they're going to not cause any substantial delay.
Can I just add to that that there's a slightly different legal framework in Canada, where claimants there do not have the legal authority to ask a court to impose an injunction against the pipeline, whereas here
they can ask.
Well, courts are under no obligation to respond.
Even if they did get awarded, say, the land claims were settled, and they got the land that the pipeline is going to go across, well, the government could still have come in and just expropriate anyway. So it didn't really matter whether it was settled or not. They may get settled later, and the government would just have to pay them later, but they'd certainly get it if they wanted.
I think the second major point that jumped out at us, sort of my comments on native land claims, is the relationship between government and industry, whether it be the oil and gas industry or any other industry. They seem to be much closer. A case in point is Foothills and AGTL filed the incentive rate of return with the NEB, and after almost no hassling whatsoever, the NEB came down with a preliminary report, and the Canadian response there, the AGTL Foothills response, was, well, we can probably live with most of that. So there's not that tug of war going on between the government sector and the private sector. They have some unusual creatures, unknown to us in Canada, called Crown Corporations. These are quasi-government entities. Some are owned 100% by the government, but as Larry mentioned, headed by very, very capable people, generally we found. And their actions are not as a government agency, but as a private corporation. They wheel and deal with what assets and what capitalization they have at their disposal. They're oftentimes given a slight leg up, which makes private enterprise howl, but yet they're very active, they're very competitive, and quite sharp. Some of these are owned outright Petro-Canada by the federal government. Others, like the Alberta Energy Company, is we were talking about before, 50% Alberta government and 50% by the Albertans, just a stock issue.
So there are a number of strange permutations and combinations which when TransCanada was put together, there was a buy-in by the government and actual ownership of a section, but then along with the buy-in was the buyout portion of it. They seem to have many more means at their disposal than we have right now for getting a job done that needs to be done.
That's something I'll add just to go along with. I visited Canada a few years ago at their request. They were concerned, the government was concerned about exporting some of their products. Something that I discovered that was similar to what you're saying. Government plays a more active, positive role in the private sector than our government does, for instance. I saw one industry, the housing industry, which typically, because of the severe winters, would normally peak in summer months of construction and lay off in the winter. So because they had, as a private industry, a limited amount of capital in which to sort of bankroll these houses that they've been selling, the government would buy the houses, assuming they, you know, these are prefab housing units. They would buy them and allow them to stockpile them so that when it came the next spring, they could go ahead and deliver them on the basis of the onrush that came in. And it kept an even employment roles going, and I saw that in several industries. Real significant benefit in terms of the reducing the unemployment that otherwise would occur in terms of seasonal employment.
You might maybe like to mention that the deal with Pat Peed, who owns part of Petro-Canada, the Crown Corporation, just took over, I guess it initially 48%, and hoped to get controlling interest in Pacific Petroleum, or Phillips's interest in Pacific Petroleum. And then Pacific Petroleum in turn owned, 50% of West Coast?
No, 33%.
33% of West Coast, who are, of course, partners with Foothills. And so the government's got a direct interest in the pipeline now.
We tried to ascertain what that meant, because that's the only government portion that's... And that happened, that deal was announced the day we got there, and we talked to Hopper twice, who's head of the Petro-Canada. What does that mean? And he kind of sat back and said, well, or do you plan any changes in the pipeline? I said, no, we just have more or less a benign interest.
But then everybody else we talked to in Canada about Hopper thought that he was anything but benign about anything. We might hear from him again.
Their excuse was they needed Pacific Petroleum for cash flow, but as a sidelight of coincidence, they also now own part of the West Coast, which is deep into the pipeline.
Well, I think the cash flow argument holds water because the shadow prime minister, who may well in fact become the prime minister sometime toward the end of next summer, has vowed to take apart Petro-Canada.
Yeah.
And by getting his short-term cash flow together, I think Petro-Canada, Mr. Hopper at Petro-Canada, can claim that he's now independent of any future draw requirement on the Federal Treasury of Canada, and in so doing, blunt any takeover or take-apart attempt by the federal government.
Well, what Mr. Cotton was saying, it sounds like not only did he get that, but he may have a few more backup options available to him, too.
That's right.
Well, they're in a whole lot of things, like you're in that Pan-Arctic deal, 245% on that LNG and the rest of that polar gas pipeline project. So you see them all over the place, integrated with the private industry.
And with each other, they have. The deals are incredible. Storms like Junk Food. It's pretty tough to follow. Any other questions or comments on Canada? What are we going to do? Budget. Everybody's been given a copy of the committee budget. That's sort of
your presentation.
That's sort of self-explanatory.
Your presentation on that?
Your
Canada thing?
Yeah.
I think this would be a good place to take care of formal approval on some of these outstanding budget items we have. Bill, we've already acted on a motion
on the
$25,000 on the GSOC. We just need your vote. It was unanimous, but you
very
much. Yeah, you
got it.
Yep.
But
if you're ready for motion,
the right now.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I move and ask unanimous consent that we approve the contract between the State of Alaska Legislative Affairs Agency and Point Well Merrill Lynch as reflected in the draft that I have before me, involving four pages.
I think everybody's been given a copy of that. Is there any comments or questions on that?
I had a question.
Oh, yes.
I'm just curious about that. Is that what you guys thought?
Yeah, I think that's one of the points that was brought up that was added on.
Do you want an amendment? An amendment to my motion that we adopt this, or is it okay with you?
Yeah, that's okay with me. I wasn't real hot on that, but that was one of the things that talked about there was interest in.
Okay, as soon as you rule on that, I didn't hear any objection. I asked for unanimous consent. I'd further like to move that Mr. Gilbert.
That's so ordered.
Yeah. I'd like to further move and ask unanimous consent that Mr. Gardner be appointed as the project head. I don't know what title we're going to give him, but project manager. This project, so that he might have immediate and up to date. Input.
They refer to it as project director.
Project director, right.
Any objections to that question?
Mr. Chairman, may I ask a question? I believe that because the funds were allocated to Legislative Council and that Greg Erickson is acting the direction of Legislative Council, and that it might be better if the motion was in the form requesting that Greg, or ordering Greg, to designate Terry Gardner as his designee, if you will, as project director. The point is an administrative one in the sense that should something happen to Terry Gardner, there would be no...
Now that's interesting.
San Francisco continues, but this project would fall apart without Mr. Gardner unless he was acting as someone's designee. So can we have the motion in that form?
Mr. Chairman, standing guided by... I move that the motion be amended to reflect his request.
Everybody understand that? You are not designated,
yeah.
Gardner.
I'll watch out.
Okay. Any objection to that motion? Okay. That's so ordered. We've had a question from Legislative Research as to how this committee is really operating in the... And Greg Erickson indicates that it would be much easier on him if we had a motion that somebody is co-chairman of this. Mr. Gardner?
Someone? Some buddies?
Some ones.
Some twos.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'll make a motion that Representative Miles and Senator Coletta be appointed the co-chairman of this committee.
Any objection to that motion? Okay, that's good. Do you want to talk about the next meeting?
Yeah, how about this Roosevelt study? Larry?
I chatted with Fred Vanessa about that just before.
Yeah. My belief is that that a contract was prepared by our staff and submitted to Greg Erickson and accepted. Unfortunately, when I got back, everybody was on vacation, and I haven't been able to confirm that fact. And so we would be prepared to go forward and present it and explain it. It would still have to be approved by the committee, of course.
Mr. Chairman, that's my understanding as well, that we have been in contact with the Department of Natural Resources. We have resolved any differences between us. We jointly agree on a plan of attack on this reservoir study, or the field economic study, and that it's just a matter of drafting the final contract and presenting it for approval back to this committee. In the meantime, we do intend to go ahead and with the committee's approval, issue an RFP or otherwise engage a contractor for the study. That, our understanding of the discussion of the last meeting, the meeting before the San Francisco meeting, was that that contract had tentative approval of the committee, but it was a matter of form and not substance. That had to be resolved.
Yeah, well, I recall the discussion, and it's exactly as you say, but has this been expanded? Because wasn't oil and gas
doing a similar study?
No, not a similar study. They were doing, in fact, a sort of a mechanical reservoir study of the relationship between producing oil and gas. And what the study that was proposed by Greg would look at is the kinds of facilities that, well, I'm simplifying, the kinds of facilities that might be placed in the field and the various mechanisms, approaches for producing it and the costs associated with doing that. One was really, Greg's study is really a follow-on and would use the study being done by oil and gas as an input in terms of the analysis. It was more economic.
That's the way I understood it, but is that the number way now? Because oil and gas isn't finished and Lanfool and Dozier isn't finished.
No, our study isn't finished other than to sort of it isn't even underway, other than with Greg what we want to look at when we've got the data to look at it.
Okay, super.
And I think we should add to that the fact that we could start looking today at some of the data coming from the two-dimensional model, and in so doing be ready to address the three-dimensional data when it is available, hopefully sometime in March. But not to delay until then.
That hasn't changed. That was the original discussion. That should be followed up then. But that's
right. Right. No, it's still proceeding in that fashion.
Well, Larry, what do you want? You need some official action then? It would seem that you should, not to exceed that amount.
All right. If having not the contract for us, it's difficult for me to ask for formal approval by the committee, but a motion to reaffirm the committee's understanding of acceptance of this study.
Well, let's encumber
contract,
the money
and encumber it for that purpose.
The contract.
You want permission to send out for
our fees? That's what
I guess that's the key.
Okay.
Although I did suggest that was our understanding already, and so we were prepared to go ahead and send out RFPs. But it would, having not done so, it would be better for us to bring it back to you now and ask for permission to do so.
Okay, come back for formal approval if you...
Of the contract itself?
Yeah.
Okay. So, is there a motion to that?
Somebody want to make a motion?
Yeah, I would so move. We encumbered the $60,000 pending approval of the contract.
Any objection to that? Okay. So
the next meeting?
Anybody got any?
I don't know. This calendar's getting pretty crowded here at the last. You guys aren't all sort of time staying, I think, right? Just saying the month of December would be totally waste, the holidays and the community. Plus the other activities that are already scheduled, the budget legislative programs. D2 there on the first week of December.
Why don't we leave it at the call of the chair, but with understanding we'd have at least 2 weeks' notice.
Yeah, well, Fred or Jack, do you see anything imminent on the horizon?
Not that we can't handle.
Okay, we'll just leave that open and probably check.
Fred, how about? Jack, I would like between now and the time we have our next meeting, if possible, you could develop some information for us. Like to have copies of Alcan's original proposal on the amounts of gas, on the viability of that line size. And also, Randy is going to request an official approval. We do have some materials, but by no means is complete. But primarily, what I would like is to graph that Northwest used, or Alcan at that time used, to strengthen their argument that the Arctic and El Paso's were too heavy a drawdown
on gas commitments. We will be getting the Van Poolen study in the next 2 to 3 weeks. And there are going to be a bunch of variables in there. Do you think we could get those?
I think so. I don't think there'd be any you know, you're asking for a bunch of materials if we get to the filing documents. And I think there's probably a set of those available.
Fred, you've got them all. You've got a part of them.
Yeah, there's a, in fact, down in Juneau, in the historical library, I think they have one wall full of documents from the filing. We also have all of those documents available in Washington, D.C., and we sent, when I left the AG's office, we sent, I think, 28 boxes to archives of pipeline stuff. I can look for it. I need a little bit more direction as to specifically what we're after.
Okay, well, what I'm looking for is, even if it would have to be a minority report out of this committee, would be alternatives to your present proposal. And that includes your initial proposal and those arguments against Arctic and El Paso on the viability of line at the 2.4 versus the...
Well, you're thinking in terms of size, capacity, alternative capacity. Okay. Now, that would, we might be able to isolate that fairly easily, if that's the focus you want.
But you really had a nice graph that you used in the congressional.
Okay.
And it seems to have been lost. You guys must have it on microfilm or something.
Right. And the supporting arguments are dated that support that graph.
Well, I was just going to...
Staff has done some research on a legal case that may bear heavily on any decisions on your gas line. It's the Shell versus FERC, and Randy Moen, your staff attorney, can make some comments on that.
Okay, basically, the Federal Power Commission issued an order which basically, depending upon your interpretation, could require gas producers to meet gas delivery obligations despite harm to the oil recovery potential of the reservoir. Now, that order is being litigated in a case called Shell versus FERC. It's before right now the U.S. Supreme Court. The case has not been calendared. It will be calendared in January or February. The court has agreed to hear the case, and they agreed on October 2nd of this year. And a statement was made on October 14th, 1977, by a man named J.R. Miller. He's the vice president of BPS Ohio in Cleveland. And I called him about his statement, and his statement was that a ruling in favor of FERC in this case could create a disincentive for BP to enter into a gas sales contract. And he referred me to Shell Oil, who's handling the case, and I spoke with their counsel, and I'm giving you there what he told me. So I'm trying to bring you up to date on the case.
In other words, once they signed a delivery commitment, they got to do that, even at the expense of...
Right. Basically, it involves, the producers are saying the federal government cannot require a producer to produce the gas. That the producers are saying, look, the federal government has jurisdiction over transportation, not production of gas, under the Natural Gas Policy Act.
Okay,
fair?
No, make a couple comments on that. This is the prudent operator rule, which the producers voiced as one of their concerns back at the end of 75 or 76, whenever the advance payment contracts came up, and the producers at that point were saying they couldn't enter into contract until the prudent operator rule was decided. It's I think 533 and 533 A and B. And essentially, the producer's argument is that the Natural Gas Act precludes looking into production, as Randall said. The FERC, and before then the FPC, approached it from the point of view of abandonment. It's part of the Section 7 of the Natural Gas Act abandonment authority. We're fairly concerned about that case, and the state will be filing an amicus brief in the case. I think it's already underway in terms of drafting jointly by people in the Attorney General's office and Bob Leffler on our behalf. And I think probably Texas and Louisiana will be filing amicus briefs as well.
Jack, are you aware of that also?
I'm aware of the circumstances. I've not followed the case.
Yeah, well, Randy, you should make available a copy of that.
I have a case right there.
The speech that BP
on appeal,
Vice President made, but Fred, you know, it seems strange that if the administration is aware of that, that here we're blindly pursuing, the construction of something that necessitates firm guarantees.
Well, in this instance, I'm not quite sure. I don't know what Mr. Miller said. I can tell you that the producers generally are much more concerned about the implications of 533B on their lower 48 production than they are with respect to Prudhoe Bay. If it is the case that there are going to have to be certain kinds of throughput agreements in order to ensure financing, then 533 is probably not inconsistent with those commitments in any event. So why he said that, I don't know what his logic or rationale was. I do know that the producers have consistently maintained with the Federal Power Commission that an adverse ruling in 533 will prohibit them from entering into gas contracts. And I certainly felt when they made those representations some 2 years ago, it was simply an effort to tell the commission that if they were expected cooperation from the producers on gas sales contracts, then they wanted something from the commission in exchange. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if that's still their position. But I don't know that I really think it has that significant implications for Prudhoe Bay production. It certainly does for Lower Cook Inlet production. It certainly does for a lot of Lower 48 production.
Arlo?
Fred or Randy could answer this, and I've sort of puzzled over it in the Natural Gas Policy Act. Doesn't the effective repeal of Section 1B of the Natural Gas Act with respect to production eliminate the legal ground that FERC is arguing for this? In other words, there's no certification of a future gas sales. Now, what is it, 603, that the 603 of the Natural Gas Policy Act appears on the surface to accept Prudhoe Bay gas, but since none of it has ever been dedicated, since it's not dedicated to interstate commerce, it would seem to me that this whole controversy wouldn't apply to Prudhoe at all. And have you people worked through that?
Well, it really goes a lot further than that, Arlen. We're getting into really sort of technical legal arguments which aren't going to be resolved, and this is why the Natural Gas Policy Act is going to be the latest lawyer's employment act. But the fact is you've got 603 defining Prudhoe Bay in a category which just doesn't exist. You've also got, and quite frankly, I think you have stayed in the forefront of this one, you've got the argument that the Natural Gas Act repeals all of their producer certification authority, and we are making that argument in Pacific Alaska LNG right now, so that they're not going to have abandonment authority over producers anymore.
Except for contracts that are already
in place.
So on the surface, that's what it says. What Congress intended, nobody's able to fathom.
But that's a whole new argument that wasn't presented at the Court of Appeals level because the GATT Act wasn't patent, so I assume there will be additional briefs or briefs on that issue as well.
Any
other comments on that subject?
Yeah, this is the order. Just the mm-hmm. It's 599, not 539, not 533.
That specifically says Pluto.
The last item on the agenda is the report that we've been charged to prepare for the legislature in January. I think it's been generally the consensus that we're not going to be able to say yea or nay to an equity investment by January. It's just not in the cards. Committee members have any suggestions as to any items that should go into the report? I think Senator Quett and I appreciate having those because we will have to get working on it pretty quick. Anything else, committee members? Adjourn.
What it's done, it just really makes the Tennessee contract harder and harder to read. After what the Supreme Court did in South Monroe, I don't know whether we got any rights left or not anyway.
Of these, I have one.
For sure.
Yeah, but I don't think it'll go much higher than 40%. That's
what I'll do is, it's a. I can just imagine it's probably just truckload.
Well,
That's a bunch of bullshit because they're dropping about 2,000 barrels a day. They got no choice. There it is.
But it's not only you that
paraffin based oil, you want to take the fire.